Hey all, thanks for tuning in. Before we get started, I just wanted to let everyone know that this episode does contain discussion about gambling and a gambling service, and you need to be of legal age, whether that be 18 or 21 or whatever the legal age is wherever you live, you need to be that to gamble. So if you are not of that legal age, do not gamble, and in fact, don't even listen to this episode. Welcome to the Super Gamer Podcast. Welcome to the new Super Gamer Podcast, episode 90. Our guest this week is considered the UK's first professional gamer. He's the founder of GamerBase, marketing director for Midnight, which is a betting platform tailored for esports fans. We have Sujoy Roy. Thank you for being here.
Hey, my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So the first professional gamer, and you were in the UK, I should say, and you were a professional when I, you know, wanted to become a professional. You were playing games that I was also playing, but I think I'm a little bit younger. But you were playing Quake. You were the best at Quake.
Yeah, suddenly you made yourself sound old there. I was just thinking that. Even as you were speaking, I was just thinking to myself, wow, this almost feels like another life now. So much has happened since then, and the world has changed so much since I was a professional gamer. But yes, I suppose that's how I got into this whole thing. My whole life has changed from that point. You were just like bringing back a lot of memories saying that.
Yeah, well, as far as your life changing, you were studying physics at Cambridge, and then Doom and Quake entered your life. And unless I'm getting this wrong, you got progressively better at those, but progressively worse at school.
Yes. I mean, I try not to repeat that too much because I was just one of those kids who only studied, and that was my whole life, and I was only interested in doing well at school. And then something else came into my life that I was just as fanatical about, and that was being the best at video games, because I was always competitive. But then these games came along where you could compete against everybody, not just the people in your room. And before the era of internet gaming, it was just a case of, can you beat the people in the room? And I always could. And I thought, okay, whatever, I've done that. Let's move on and do something useful with my life. But then when the stakes got much bigger and you could play anybody in the world, suddenly, you know, the competition was endless. And that was just this amazing challenge to me. It was like a challenging me. How good can you really be? And, you know, I'm the kind of person that I love this kind of challenge and I want to take it on.
Yeah, well, I remember when I want to say it was OGL was the one that my friend and I were into. Yeah. We played a lot of Counter-Strike, like the original Counter-Strike, and I was never good at it, but I was I was young enough that I was like, you know, we're going to make a 2v2 team and we're going to go to the top kind of thing. And they had that OGL and different websites where you could actually see where you ranked. So it was, you know, it seemed like a big deal, but that's kind of for you, Quake World came about, and that's when you realized, oh, I'm actually the best player in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it was, oh, I don't know if I'd say it's a surprise to me, because we kind of knew other great players around Europe, at least, because there'd be talk of a great player. It felt a bit like the Wild West in that there were these legends of certain people who were incredible at the game, and there'd be whispers of them in forums and email lists and things like that. You know, we actually knew who the great players were, and every so often there'd be this showdown where your fans would be shit talking their fans, right? And eventually you'd have the game against each other, and it was just this huge deal, a lot of pressure on you to win this game. We had stuff like that happening all the time. But we didn't have those, you know, the big world championships that you have now where you can really determine who's the best. It took a while for that to happen. But Quakeworld put the ranking system on. And as soon as they did that, I was like, okay, forget this. All I'm interested in now is Quakeworld. Nothing else matters. I need to get to number one on this list. And yeah, eventually I got there.
Cool. When you, so you actually quit a high-paying job at a banking institution in the U.S. To pursue your gaming career, and evidently it worked out. I've heard you say it wasn't totally unprecedented for your family. Your parents had quit their jobs to become photographers, so like following your dream wasn't unprecedented. But in the late 90s, you know, generally, was it just hard to sell to people like, oh, I'm going to make a living playing games?
Oh, God, yes. And I don't know, if you go and ask my mother still, she'll probably say, no, you should have stayed at the bank. She would have had a pretty straightforward life. But I mean, who wants a straightforward life, right? You got to chase your dreams to be a real person. It's like whatever it is you're fanatical about, you got to chase that stuff. Otherwise, you'll always regret it. So I don't. I would have had a simpler life if I'd stayed at the bank. Sorry, what was the original question? Was it
just how weird it must have been telling people at that time?
Yeah, and I'll tell you this, the when I explained to the people at the bank, it was JP Morgan, what I was doing, they just didn't get it. They didn't understand. And I think at the time, so my plan was, okay, I'm going to quit this great job at JP Morgan. I'm going to move to Sweden and train as a pro gamer with the best players in the world there, make sure I stayed on top. I think one of them bought me a sort of guide to Switzerland for some reason. He got it all wrong. Still got it on my shelf, actually, funnily enough. That was my boss. They had no idea what I was doing. They thought I was mad. I don't know, just got funny looks, and I guess that's why they never asked me to come back.
Sometimes I wonder about today, esports is now an established thing, it's not out. No one would go, well, you're crazy to even try it. But I feel like maybe kids now, in a similar way to sports, it's like, I'm going to be a professional, whatever. Like, maybe that's a bad thing. I mean, there's only, a handful of people who make it, but games are such a, it's so easy, I think, as a kid to trick yourself into like, well, I'm good enough, I'm going to make it.
Well, it's easy. I mean, these labels, good and bad. I mean, they're always relative, really, aren't they? It's like anything else you could be great at now. So what it used to be was that games were not understood to be a thing you should be devoted to back then, right? And obviously, so many people were and are now just game fanatics. But back then, saying that you were going to just invest your life in playing video games was outrageous. But yeah, I'm not going to comment on whether someone should devote their life to being the best at anything. But gaming now is just part of the culture, right? The same way any sport, if you're a fanatical about basketball or football or anything else or tennis, it's okay, right? It's understood what it is you're trying to achieve. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to get there, right? Because one thing that's happened is the stakes in gaming are so high now, you really have to be not just world class, top 0.0001% of people to make some kind of living from it, same as you would in any other professional sport. Gaming feels more accessible, maybe. I'm not sure. But yeah, you got to balance this up in your own life, right? But I mean, if you got a dream, you don't want to lose that either.
And as you've demonstrated, there's more to working in the gaming sphere than being a professional player. I mean, like, you're the founder of Gamerbase, you've built venues, you market for an esports betting company. Like, there's a lot you can do.
So I think it perhaps more so earlier on in the industry, because when I started, there wasn't an industry. So I had to have two heads, one as the gamer and one as the businessman, to build a lot of the infrastructure. We actually built the first real sort of portal for esports news back then, because it didn't exist. And we were doing two things at once, really, in this business. But I think it's still a very young industry, and we're seeing it change all the time. So now it's the influencer industry. It is about building this massive social following, understanding how to talk to people, because this is what businesses fail in these days, right? It's understanding the younger generation of people, because they're so different. It's so different the way people communicate now, and the way you reach your audience. It's changed so much so quickly that there's this disconnect. And as anyone who works somewhere in these niche industries, and this one's esports, you have to learn that to become good at your trade, because it's not just about being a professional gamer. It's about creating this image of yourself, making yourself saleable, making yourself sponsorable, getting partners, and getting your sphere of influence, making it as big as possible to make yourself valuable. So Yeah, I mean, if you've got the head for it, you can create not just yourself as a pro gamer, but also yourself as a saleable asset. And we've seen it in this industry, haven't we? People like, well, say Ninja as a gamer has turned himself into a property, and but someone more so, say Dr. Disrespect, right? He created a property which has just exploded, right? And he's one of the most recognizable people, right? Not just gamers, just one of the most recognizable people.
Have you ever considered coaching in esports?
Myself, I did a little actually back in the day. There's been all sorts of leagues, and at one point, News Corp decided to set up a league called the Championship Gaming Series, and I was the franchise manager for the London team, which was called the London Mint. We did all these really embarrassing segues and stuff like that, where we playing with coins and throwing money around, obviously, as the London Mint. And I was all dressed up to the nines in a proper business suit. But I guess what my job was really was trying to get our team into the right place. And I tried to use my knowledge from being a gamer. And the thing is, if you're trying to compete on the very highest level, it's no longer just about your mechanical abilities, right? Anyone can be great at games, but to become a professional esports star, you've got to operate at that incredible level, also under the most intense pressure. And that's the trick, right? And I think it's like this in most sports, right? It's one thing to be incredibly talented. It's another thing to play at your best level when it really counts. And that's when you come in clutch. That's when you really find out if you've got what it takes to become world class and a star.
One thing I was surprised to hear, you are credited as the first to record a rocket jump out of a specific lava part in Quake, but also like movement you've explained before is really what separated the best from, great players in Quake. You could exploit to like bunny hop, get faster and faster, move so fast. But because of that, what surprises me is you didn't make the transition to Quake 2 because it had that grappling hook mod, which made you go really fast.
We had mods like that in Quake 1 as well. They had, but that's the thing. I think every sort of game has its own series, own set of devotees who will exploit it to the maximum. If you look at games done quick now, I'm sure you've seen stuff where they're speed running games. I've seen all sorts of series on YouTube as well, where the game devs are watching people find all these crazy exploits in their games to skip bits. There's exploits in whatever game, and I thought Quake 1 was more interesting because there was like. It was just the skill level, I thought, was the skill cap of moving was interesting. But yeah, I mean, Quake 2 had it all as well. There's no point. We're way past that. There was an era where I was, defending Quake 1 versus Quake 2, but I think we're past that now. We can all be friends. If you're a Quake 2 fan, it's fine. We can be friends.
Well, you brought something up kind of along these lines. In 2018 on The Sportsman, you mentioned that Quake didn't last. Like, the game that you were a pro at just sort of went away. And I never really thought about that before. But yeah, unlike, established sports, video games, some of them have a shelf life. And do you think that will happen with any of today's big esports? Like, I guess Counter-Strike's got to be the longest running at this point.
It'll happen. And it's a sad day, isn't it? And games, yeah, unlike sports, do that. They, because the game, it's not the same as a sport because someone owns the game, right? And their business model for success is generally releasing another game. But yeah, I mean, the script's been flipped, right? People like Riot, working on League of Legends, will just keep evolving that game. But will it last forever? I mean, if we come back in 10 years, will League of Legends still be the most popular MOBA? I don't know. I just I wouldn't count on it. If you ask me to place a bet, will Counter-Strike, League of Legends, Call of Duty, will they all ex well, Call of Duty, I mean, that probably will exist forever. But will Counter-Strike and League of Legends still exist? These sort of accidentally brilliant games, as they are now? Somehow I don't think so. I think I don't even know what the next evolution will be because we're going mobile now, right? And technology is changing. VR sort of is a bit hit or miss right now, but maybe one day they'll make it work properly. And maybe new franchises will become the hot game, the one everyone wants to become best at. So I don't know. If you ask me if all the games we know will be around in 10 days, in 10 years, I wouldn't be so sure.
The one game for me that I can't believe didn't really take off, like it is an esport, but certainly not on the level of, League or whatever, is Rocket League. Because when that first came out, it instantly for me, I was like, well, this is such a great spectator game. Like, it's 5 minutes. We all understand soccer, and it's rocket-powered soccer.
That's you're right. It really makes sense as a spectator sport, doesn't it? And I don't want to take anything away from the players of Rocket League. I've seen the great players of Rocket League, and they just do. You've seen them, right? They do incredible stuff in the game, like juggling in the air, and it blows my mind. So I think the thing to take away is that you can never tell what's gonna be successful, and there's not a formula, so it's a tough one, and it makes it tough for game developers to know where to be successful. Yeah, that's the thing. It's a mystery. It's a mystery what gets popular.
Are there any games that you still play competitively?
Not many so much. We have a work league of Counter-Strike, which I'm not as great as I used to be at. I still every so often I'll pull off a shot that's just crazy. But then most of the time I'm still trying to figure out. I don't play Counter-Strike properly, and they don't want to play 1v1 arena with me, so I never get to show off my skills. What I do play religiously is on my phone, which is Clash Royale now, and I'm not the best because I don't put in the time, but I take it pretty seriously. I play every single day.
Cool. How often were you accused of cheating when you played Quake?
In the early days, very often, because we didn't have what's it, people didn't know that you were good at the game, right? So you'd always be accused of cheating. But then obviously once there is a professional scene and be like, oh yeah, it's Sucho, then they're not going to accuse me of cheating anymore. So yeah, in the old days, it would be all the time. But that was an accolade. That was literally the thing you aim for. If someone accuses you of cheating, there's not a better compliment you can have, right?
Were you in your heyday, were you better at Quake or Bomberman?
Oh, definitely Quake. I love Bomberman just because of that social thing. Everyone around the same screen is just a great feeling when you didn't have internet gaming. But the breadth of Quake and that, just the scope of it and the ability to communicate something incredible, do something incredible, and sort of be able to see it, and for other people to watch you do it and be wowed is something. That's what blew me away about playing Quake is to do something so incredible that everyone watching just gasps, right? And I don't think you got so much scope in games like Bomberman to do that, unfortunately.
I think we had very opposite lives when internet became big with games, because I remember when I was a little kid and playing like Mario or whatever, like kids would gather around to watch me play and be like, wow, he's so good. And then the internet came about and it was like, oh, I'm terrible. Everyone else is way better than me.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. You can only play the room you've got, right? You can only impress the people in front of you. And unfortunately, the internet means that everybody can watch you. So suddenly you've got to be a lot more impressive.
Right. You are of the mind that loot boxes are gambling.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there's a lot of subtleties in this. So I don't want to make any absolute statements. But if you are paying money to open a box in the hope that you get something, let's say you're paying $1 for a box, right? and maybe there's a $100 item in there, or maybe there's a 1 cent item in there. That's gambling, surely, especially in a lot of these engines like on Steam, where there's a resale market. This is literal real money you are playing with. There's no way to say that's not gambling. It gets much more complicated in the case of, say, EA games and Star Wars Battlefront, where you can't resell items, and what else? Overwatch, I don't think you can resell items, and it's different. But the principle's there. You're gambling a set amount of money in the hope that you get something that's worth more than that, even if it's not for resale. There's an element of gambling in there. The question is how damaging is it? Where should people underage be doing this? We've definitely heard you must have heard horror stories, right, of kids using their parents' mm-hmm. credit cards and going crazy with that. And what's that doing to the kid? It's teaching them the fun of gambling, but without the responsibility of knowing what it is they're doing. There are definite issues there. And if you're not calling it gambling, you're sort of bypassing a lot of rules. Like me as a marketing director of Midnight, right? I work with gambling day in, day out. Means every time we do a promotion, we post something on Twitter, we create advertising, we think very carefully about who's seeing it, which audience is seeing it, how old are they. If they're not old enough, I need to be careful about what I'm saying. If it's got a call to action for gambling, I need to make sure it's done in a responsible way, that there's certain safeguards in there. So if I want to advertise on Facebook, you know, they're very careful to check our license and whether we're in the right region, talking to the right people. If you're on that borderline of not calling it gambling, suddenly you don't have to do any of those things, which is insane to me, because I know how careful I have to be with my messaging. So that's kind of, you know, I've got a biased point of view, let's be honest, because I do work in gambling and I work under this regulation, which is very strict. I don't disagree that it should be strict, but I think that all of these things that are basically gambling, maybe we should be having a conversation about, should they be regulated? Should people understand what it is they're doing? If you're getting a kid hooked onto gambling, that's not a good thing. They need to understand what they're doing before that happens.
Do you see any way, I mean, considering the fact that, I mean, games are, kids can get games, there's no like stopping them from doing that. Is there any way to regulate loot boxes and make sure kids don't go wild with them that isn't just do away with loot boxes?
But that's the thing, like, it depends on what. So I know game developers as well. Sorry, let me take this a step back.
Sure.
People who are developing these games and the mechanisms for customizable items, you know, all this extra digital stuff you can get in the game. Now, when they put it in the game, it's no accident that it feels like gambling. They're doing this on purpose because they know this element of gambling will make it more fun, but also reduce their overall cost of the sale, right? They know this. It's not some happy accident that it feels a bit like gambling. It was designed that way. So you know, I won't take this excuse of, oh, we didn't realize. They know exactly what they're doing. The question is where's the line? When do you start saying we should be careful with this? This is no longer just a game. We're creating elements of gambling, so it needs to be regulated. I think at first, because governments are always slow, the industry needs to self-regulate a lot of this stuff, just so that you don't get to this area where you're creating massive amounts of controversy. But at some point, if people don't self-regulate and you've got what I would consider to be damaging mechanisms in a game, that's when a government actually has to step in and say, hey, you've stepped over the line. You've done something wrong. And we've seen it in Europe. I think, was it Belgium was the first, one of the first countries in Europe that has just said, look, stop doing that. That's gambling. You know it's gambling. Stop doing it. You're not allowed anymore. It just would be a shame. This is when government starts to tell industry how to act in a very specific way, it becomes very heavy-handed. So I would hope that the games industry would just take note and say, yeah, we know we're introducing gambling in it. Let's scale this back. Let's make it a fun game experience rather than a gambling experience. And then we won't get in these murky waters. It's a bit of corporate greed that's causing this.
All right, I got a couple more questions. One, in 2019, Prince Harry said Fortnite should be banned, and you took issue with this. Did you manage to talk with the man?
I sent a message. No, I didn't. Well, here's the thing: is that I on the loot box thing, I will take a stand for what I think is right. For the industry to do. But on the flip side, when other people outside of the industry start talking about games and they have no idea what they're talking about, I take issue with that, right? Because as a gamer, you know, this is my tribe of people, right? I understand how the games work and how the people who play appreciate it and come together and find, you know, this common interest with people. It's a beautiful thing, right? We should be celebrating this stuff. So when someone from the outside makes this just like really crude comments about games, not even understanding what they're talking about, I have a problem with that. Yeah, that's all. And it happens all the time. You know, you should probably just, you know, not notice it. The issue is when someone who's got a royal title does it, they get more notice, right? And then I worry that governments who, as I said, they come in very heavy-handed, they can come in and like do real damage. And that's why I felt like I had to speak out.
All right. Finally, I'll just, you know, whether this be the next big game or where betting's going or a new infrastructure or something, where do you see esports going in the future? What's the next step?
I mean, it's already come a long way. You know that, right? We celebrate the greatest players and I love it. I think where it's going is that the technology will keep improving. And here's something I see, right, in my industry. I see that people who are playing and watching sports are getting older, you know, the demographics going up, and people who are watching esports and are fans of esports stars, they're this younger generation, but they're also growing up as well. And they've got all the buying power and everyone else is trying to reach the audience. And how do they do that? They do that through esports. I think that's going to happen more and more. People will take it seriously. We're going to have our bumps in the road of trying things. And, you know, I think it's a big mistake to go to the Olympics and things like that, because you're introducing esports to this old system of fuddy-duddy people who have no idea what they're doing. We're going to see bumps in the road, but eventually, I mean, we're already almost there. Esports will be accepted just as a very, you know, the best of the best. And we won't have to make excuses anymore for us having this nerdy lifestyle. It's just the lifestyle. We'll lose the nerdy, I think.
Well, if people want to learn more about our guest, sujoy.com, sujoy.com. Sujoy Roy, thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for plugging my website. I don't really use it anymore.
Oh, but, wow.
There's some fun stuff on there. You can see my old clippings of interviews when I was young.
Well, they can check out Midnight, too, if they're interested.
Oh, yeah. But only if you're over 18 and
yes, in the or right possibly 21, depending on where you're listening to this.
Of course, yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much.